All right. Well, welcome to today's episode of the Who We Are podcast, a mental health podcast. I'm your host, Zach Moloch. And today I have the absolute privilege of speaking with Alyssa. Thanks for being here, Alyssa.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. So if you don't mind, let's introduce yourself to the world here and tell us a little bit about who Alyssa is.
All right. Hi, everyone. I'm Alyssa. I'm married. I have a 2.5-year-old daughter. I have a dog named Jingle Bells. My family is very into Christmas. And most of all, I'm super passionate about mental health. And I just wanted to be here to kind of tell my story, to connect with other people, and talk about treatment-resistant depression.
Treatment-resistant depression, that's something that I'm not too familiar with. So I'm definitely glad you're here to teach us about that and speak into that. Can you identify what that is for us?
Absolutely. So treatment-resistant depression is defined basically when someone is diagnosed with depression and they haven't responded to two or more first-line antidepressants, which are usually SSRIs or SNRIs. Okay. So basically, anytime that someone has depression, they haven't responded to like your typical SSRI or SNRI, and they've tried at least two different ones, that's when you would be diagnosed with treatment-resistant depression.
Okay. And that definitely makes sense. So it's quite the journey, I imagine, right?
Absolutely.
Like getting to that point of, and it just before you get into your story, it almost sounds, I guess, in a sense, painful, you know, to try to get this relief that you're seeking for depression and it's just not being relieved. That's kind of what I'm hearing, right?
Yes. I think that's the biggest thing about treatment-resistant depression is kind of that loss of hope that can come with it, because you first have to accept that, okay, I'm struggling with depression. And then you have to accept help, which can always be hard as well. But then when that help maybe isn't helping as much as you thought that it would, that mm-hmm. can be where things can also get really frustrating. And you can try a lot of different treatments and you can just kind of hit a wall where you feel like, okay, have I tried everything? Mm-hmm. And so maintaining that hope can be really challenging.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And we've got a couple of previous episodes that we've done on the Who We Are podcast that really got your attention, right? And what were those?
Yes. Yeah, so the Major Depressive Disorder podcast, it definitely resonated with me. And then I would say the Postpartum Depression podcast was just completely touched my heart, because I did suffer with postpartum depression after having my daughter. And that was some of the darkest times of my life. And so that was something that it's such a beautiful time in your life. And then to also be struggling so hard and to feel like you're missing out on what should be so joyous is just that was really challenging for me. So hearing that podcast was just so meaningful to me to hear someone else have that same experience and how they got through it. And that was one of the reasons why I wanted to come and tell my story too.
Yeah. And I was getting ready to ask, you know, why this really matters to you. And you just answered that. Mm-hmm. What I'm hearing is that you were made to not feel so alone when you heard those podcasts, and you want to do the same for others, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I think it's so important, at least for me in my mental health journey, to feel like there's a purpose for the reasons why we suffer from these things. And that can be to have compassion for others, to connect with others, to share hope with others. Mm-hmm. So to feel like there's a reason.
Yeah, I love that. I feel the same way. So this is going to be great. An astonishing statistic that I'm looking at here, it really blew my mind. I see that 1 in 10 people have depression. That wasn't so surprising, but to hear that 30-40% of people with depression have treatment resistant depression, that honestly blew my mind.
Yes, it's shocking.
Yeah.
To think about, you hear a lot of stories of people who have depression and then maybe they take an SSRI and that can be life changing, which is wonderful. Mm-hmm. But there is this large segment of the population that has depression that they've tried SSRIs, they've tried SNRIs, and it's maybe not, maybe it helps a little bit, but it's not that life changing experience that we want for them.
Yeah. And to go back just a little bit, the SSRIs and the SNRIs, let's let everybody know what those are. I'm pretty sure that people do know what those are,
yes.
But let's define those. So the SSRI is a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, mm-hmm. right? And the SNRI, is that a selective
norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so are these things like balancing the chemicals, or are they... I get the two mixed up.
Okay. So my understanding is that basically they block the receptors so that instead of the serotonin being like taken back up, or the norepinephrine, it remains in your brain so that you can have more of those pleasure chemicals to use.
Okay, so there's not the necessarily like the highs and lows, right? It kind of keeps this even keel.
That's my understanding.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And that definitely makes sense. And here I am, you know, asking about these, and I'm on one. So it definitely helps knowing what I'm taking, right?
Yeah.
And this is a very, very, like, personally important episode to me. You know, being 41 years old, there's been multiple times where I thought there was no hope. Mm-hmm. And the treatment that I was seeking wasn't working. And it was like, oh my gosh, like, I've got to try something else, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, a lot of these medications, you've got to be on them for like 3 to 6 months.
Yes.
To see if there's any difference. It got to such an extreme point for me. And I love that this is part of your story. I'm going to kind of give a glimpse. But it's the TMS therapy, the transmagnetic stimulation therapy. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yes.
That right? Yep. That was life-changing. Now, I'll be very upfront. Like, it didn't eliminate it from me at all, but it did something that nothing else did, and that gave me, like, a consistent I just lost the word, but because it's a consistent treatment. Like, for me, it was 36 sessions.
Yes.
And it was every day, Monday through Friday. I got Saturday and Sunday off. But that consistency in receiving that daily treatment where I had to physically go somewhere to receive it, and we'll let you speak about what exactly it is, that was just extremely helpful to me. And I have not just, and I'm disclosing this to you for the first time, but I've never met anybody else who has had that same therapy.
Wow.
Yeah. So you and I are two peas in a pod when it comes to that. And I'm just so excited to hear about that.
Yeah.
And
TMS is awesome.
It really is. And some people may be like on the other end listening to this, and we sound really cheerful right now and excited. And we just want to let you guys know that it's because we're sitting here across from each other, and we're one and the same in the sense of what we dealt with over the past 20 to 30 years. And it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen when you come across these people who really get it, who are sitting on the other side of the table and who are getting it. Would you agree?
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
I think you'll hear in my story that connecting with people who have the same or similar struggles to you has been probably the most healing thing in my entire journey.
Yes. And I got to just tell you, Alyssa, just meeting you, you know, 5 weeks ago has boosted my encouragement. Like, it's actually given me hope just in talking with you these several different times. And again, it's just for the sheer fact of, hey, there's somebody else who gets it. And it's almost like that. I know I'm not saying it right, but I'm just going to say it anyway. It's like that trauma bond,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, I know can actually be deemed a negative term, but like in this sense, it brings a sense of calmness over me.
Yeah.
And I would hope it does the same for you.
It does, okay. For sure. So I think like one of the reasons why it's so amazing is just because we, maybe having been through therapy or things like that, we are very authentic people. And so we're open about our experiences. And I think that a lot of people in the world are not quite there. And so there's still, you know, maybe like there's shame or there's other emotions around sharing these experiences that make it difficult. But for us, we kind of have nothing to lose. So we're like, let me tell you everything and let me hear your story and let's connect. And I just think that's such a beautiful thing. And it, again, it gives purpose to what we're going through.
It definitely does. All right. So, you know, again, thanks for being here and sharing all this stuff with us. And we're just going to dive right in. We've defined what treatment-resistant depression is. We've talked about the difference between SSRIs and SNRIs. And then now I'd like to get into really the journey, if you don't mind, of how you came to know that it was even TRD.
Yeah, so I'll just kind of tell you my whole story. So I would say I started probably experiencing depression when I was about 10 years old, and I didn't really realize at the time that that's what it was. I just knew I felt different from other kids. I felt more melancholy. I would have times where I would cry for no reason, and I just didn't understand why I felt so down. I had really, really low self-esteem and a lot of negative like self-talk and the way that I thought about myself. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize at the time that those are all symptoms of depression. And so when I finally started to realize that was kind of in high school, I first heard about anxiety and depression. I first realized actually that I had panic attacks because that's kind of evident, you know, with the racing heart and racing thoughts and just the way that a panic attack feels. When someone described it, I was like, oh, that's what I've been having. So I first found out like, okay, I have panic attacks. And so that means I probably also have anxiety. And then from there, I started to realize like I'm having these really, really negative thoughts and even like thoughts of death. And so that was something that I was like, oh, this isn't normal. And so I realized in high school, I think I suffer from anxiety and depression, but I was just so afraid to tell anyone. I was afraid what people would think about me, if it would change the way that they saw me, like even my family. And I also just didn't want to be a burden. I didn't want people to feel like they had to take care of me, that I wasn't self-sufficient. And so I just kept it quiet for a really long time. I started to like think about getting help in college. I went to the therapist that they had there on campus, and I was kind of weirded out by the whole thing and gave up on it pretty quickly. And then finally, when I was in my 20s, it just became to a point that I couldn't deny it anymore. I was crying at work. I couldn't concentrate on anything. Nothing made me happy. I felt down all the time. And the low self-esteem and the negative self-talk was just constant.
So in high school, because for me, like that's where I started experiencing it. Well, you said it, like this sense of just melancholy and just, it was strange, but I couldn't name it.
Mm-hmm.
Like I had no clue. And, you know, I think a lot of times people are quick to blame our parents.
Yes.
And I'll be transparent. Like I went through a phase of that because I needed somebody or something to blame my feelings on. So that was just the easiest and closest people to project that on. But I don't think that they were necessarily prepared either, right? The generations as they go back, like it's more of a, you know, pull up your bootstraps, rub some dirt on it, man up, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in my high school years, I remember the year it came on. I was 14 years old. But I, again, still didn't know what it was. So I was quick to just mask it with humor, the popularity, you know, and I got into, you know, smoking weed just to fit in and things like that. Did you have anybody in high school, a friend or anything that was able to help you name these feelings aside from what you knew in regards to like the panic disorder, like you said, you felt, you knew what that was. But how did you come to know these feelings were depression?
I honestly, I'm not sure that I can tell you. I really didn't have anyone. And that was not because people didn't want to help me, but more because I was so afraid of showing it that I did exactly what you did. I masked it completely. I was involved in dance. I was a super high achiever in school. So nobody really thought anything was wrong.
Yeah. And that makes sense. That was the same. I still talk to people today who hear these podcasts and like, Zach, I had no clue that you dealt with any of that.
Mm-hmm.
And we get really good at faking it. I mean, it becomes almost somebody we believe who we are, but at the same time, behind the mask and behind the activities, there's a lot of pain there.
Yeah.
So did you have, and if I'm crossing the line, just tell me, but did you have family that would pry and say, hey, you know, what's going on? Like, I'm noticing this. Like, how much were they involved in your diagnosis?
They really weren't involved until later, and I really kept that to myself for a very long time. I have family members who have suffered from depression and other mental illness. So, you know, like you, I went through a period of time where I was confused why maybe people didn't reach out to me more or understand what I was going through. But again, like, I think that I was doing a really good job of covering it up in some ways. And so, yeah, my parents and didn't even know that I was suffering from depression until maybe about 4 years ago, and really not until after I had my daughter and I had postpartum depression was I like kind of telling them like on a more steady basis, like, this is what's going on and I'm not doing well, because at that point, I couldn't. And that's really the only reason why, is because I just got to a place where I could no longer hide it.
Mm-hmm. So, wow. I didn't know that. So you were carrying this for a long time.
Yes.
Without family knowing, is what it sounds like. So in your 20s, you said you got to the point where you did ask for help and you went to the counselor in college, which... Mm-hmm. Why was that weird? I'm curious.
I think because I had a lot of negative beliefs about counseling and okay. about who needed counseling. And again, like, I was this super high achiever and I just wanted to do everything on my own, and I wanted to prove that I was good enough. And I think it's also because I was telling myself, you're not good enough. And so I'm trying to prove against what my own belief is. And so when I went there, it felt like a failure. It felt like I was... it just felt like I shouldn't need to be here. And so I gave up on it way too quickly. And also maybe I didn't connect with a counselor right away, which I think is an important thing to talk about too, is sometimes, like, I'm such a big believer in therapy. I've been in therapy for 8 years, but I've had different counselors throughout that time. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so important to have a connection with your counselor and feel like you can trust them and feel like what you're getting from them is helpful, because sometimes too, they can be a great counselor and you can be getting things from them, but then you reach a point in your life where you need something different. And so I've tried all different types of therapy because I've needed different things at different times.
I'm glad you said that, 'cause that's very important. A lot of times, you know, the courage that it takes to even step into a counselor's office or a therapist's office or a psychologist, psychiatrist's office, that takes a lot, right? Like, that takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of willpower, a lot of, you know, fill in the blank to even get there. So for me, I've heard from a lot, and I even experienced this at one time. I felt an obligation to my counselor,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, it's almost like I owed it to them.
It
was a weird feeling. And I think that's just part of the mental illness, right? Like, it's just this attachment, this codependency, whatever we want to call it at that time, but it does evolve.
Mm-hmm.
And there's going to be times where that particular counselor worked for a year or two,
right?
But you're in a different phase of life, right? And so it's important to let people know that it's okay to break up with your counselor.
Yes.
It's 100% okay. They're equipped for that, you know, whereas we may not be, but that makes it a little easier. You would hope it would make a little easier. So I'm really glad that you spoke into that, because, like I said, I think a lot of people feel that they're tied to one sense of treatment when there's so many different types of treatment out there that could be helpful.
Yeah. And it's so funny because I'll speak for myself. I wanted to make my therapist, like, proud of me. I wanted mm-hmm. them to think well of me. I've struggled a lot with having this low self-esteem. I look to other people to kind of give me self-esteem and be like, okay, do you think I'm good enough? Mm-hmm. And so I would do that with my counselors too. And so just realizing that, you know, that's not the purpose, and you can do what's best for you and not try to be thinking about what's best for your therapist. I mean, they're there sure. for you, but it's a funny thing to say, but when you're in it, it's very real. I think for most people, it's difficult to break up with their therapist.
It is. I mean, it's extremely difficult. Like, I've read books and there's millions of podcasts literally on how to break up with your therapist.
Oh my goodness.
So it's definitely a real thing. So anybody listening out there, if you're questioning your therapist, just know it's okay to break up with them and move on. That being said, therapy is a tool in a large toolbox, mm-hmm. right? So what are some of the things that you tried over the years, and were there glimpses of hope within each treatment that you tried?
I would say absolutely. It's funny with, like, treatment-resistant depression, it's easy to think that means no treatment worked at all. But that wasn't the case for me. For me, I found benefit in almost everything that I tried, but I just still had that persistent depression that wasn't completely relieved, that I, you know, just kind of had to live with on a daily basis. And really what a lot of these things helped me do was to manage it. So I tried Christian counseling, CBT, EMDR. EMDR is for PTSD, and I highly, highly recommend that. DBT, I've done hypnotherapy, and then I've done a lot of like group therapy. And after having my daughter, I actually went into partial hospitalization and intensive outpatient programs. And so those are very much structured around group therapy. And I just found that to be one of the most life-changing things that I've done.
Yeah.
Just like we talked about before, meeting people who really understand what you're going through, where you feel like you can be completely authentic and open about every single experience that you're having, just a safe place and a place to connect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's, you're absolutely right. Community and connection has been, well, the bulk, I think, of my just continued healing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, finding people that could get it, like we mentioned earlier, and just being with people who want to see you do well. Right. Like we're all rooting for each other.
Yes.
And not everybody does that, you know, and we faced some of that, you know, some of the things that come out of our mouths can be off-putting,
mm-hmm.
you know, but it's that sense of desperation. You know, we want people to know and we want people to hear us and see us and, you know that we have a purpose. And but it can hurt. It can hurt. So being in that like that community, the support groups, everything you just said, I think it's definitely, yeah. definitely helpful. Would you mind highlighting those different treatments and kind of elaborating on what they are individually?
Yes. So I started off with Christian counseling. I had a fabulous counselor, and I've gone to her on and off for the past 8 years. And she's someone that I kind of have that relationship where I can say, okay, right now I think I need something else, and then but I can come back to you. And so we've had this just incredible relationship, and I just find so much wisdom in what she says and so much hope. So I think that if you're a person that draws strength from your faith, that can be a very powerful type of counseling, because it's just this higher power that gives you that. That energy to keep going, that hope, the stories of resilience, all of those things. CBT is cognitive behavioral therapy. And my understanding of how that works is kind of identifying your thoughts and emotions and how they're connected, and coming up with strategies to kind of manage that. And so that really helped with the negative self-talk. I'm not going to say I'm healed from that. Definitely still a struggle, but it helps me to at least slow down to now identify, okay, I'm saying something negative to myself. How can I reframe this?
Mm-hmm.
Why am I saying this? What emotion am I feeling? Where is it in my body? And being able to kind of like sit with that and not like go to something to soothe it. Because, I mean, I think that's why sometimes people turn to drinking or turn to food, or because we don't even realize what we're feeling and that we're trying to like soothe an emotion. So I think that was really powerful for that reason. DBT is dialectical behavioral therapy. One of the things that I got from that is radical acceptance. So that is about really kind of coming to that place where you say, okay, my life might not look the way that I thought that it would, and I may always struggle with these mental health issues, but what are the positives from that? And what are the ways that I can manage this? And so I think I found the radical acceptance part of that to be really powerful for someone with treatment-resistant depression, where this may not be something that you're going to take a pill and immediately feel better.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really powerful for me. Then the EMDR, that was extremely helpful for me with some PTSD from childhood, from a bad relationship that I had had. And you don't realize how many of your negative beliefs about yourself and the way that you treat yourself can be related to traumas that you've had in the past. Mm-hmm. And I do believe like everybody has probably gone through some mm-hmm. trauma in their life. I don't think we escape this world without trauma. So even if you think your trauma is maybe not big enough, I really think that trauma, it rewires our brain, and it's just a huge thing to address. And so I highly recommend for anyone to do EMDR. Basically what it does is it helps you to reprocess those memories. So it basically kind of moves the memory into like a long-term memory instead of being at the forefront of your brain, to where it's constantly butting up against you and telling you these negative things about yourself and reminding you like of the trauma, even though you don't realize that you're thinking about it all the time. But there's little triggers and things that are bringing it up for you. It might be the color of something or the way that a room feels or anything. You don't even realize it's reminding you of these past experiences, and it's causing your brain to react in a less than optimal way. So I highly recommend EMDR.
Yeah, it definitely sounds beneficial. And then I see hypnotherapy.
Yes. Yeah, so I've just started that. I've done that a little bit. It's different from what you would think. It's not, the person waving the clock in front of your eyes, but it's basically just, it's very similar to EMDR. It's kind of just getting yourself into a more relaxed state so that you can be more open to process things. And a lot of it is trauma work as well.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then of course, group therapy. We definitely know the benefits of that. We mm-hmm. talked a little bit about that. What is PHP?
So PHP stands for Partial Hospitalization Program. Okay. So I did the Partial Hospitalization Program, which then leads into an intensive outpatient program. So I've done two of those, actually. One was faith-based, and then one was secular. And both were phenomenal experiences. Basically, what it is you are in you're in therapy for like 3 hours a day, every day, Monday through Friday. And you might do like some art therapy. You might do some individual therapy, but the majority of it is that group therapy.
Okay.
And I found that just to be amazing. And really getting down to the root of issues quickly, because you're focused on it for a long period of time and you're able to talk through things, and people are bringing things up that are triggering something in you, and you're like, oh, I never thought about it that way. And so I think that's one of the other benefits of group therapy, is like people bring things to your attention that you wouldn't come to on your own in individual therapy necessarily. So I found that super helpful. And then
change.
Yeah. And you can learn from people, how do they manage their depression and things like that. And so we're kind of getting little tips and tricks from each other and stuff too. But also just building the connections. My first IOP program, I have stayed in touch with a couple of people. My second IOP program, I've stayed in touch with a lot of different people, and we have like actually formed our own little support group. And so I think just the connections, again, of people that are similar to you, have gone through similar things, and they can really understand, and like they don't think like mental health is just think positively, or, you know, they really understand like how it impacts you on a daily basis. And so I think just having those people to reach out to when you're not doing well, and they can encourage you, it's just invaluable.
Yeah. And it's not like we don't want to be positive.
Right.
We try on a daily basis to wake up positive and to do things that are positive. But yeah, it's I struggle with that. As far as the positivity in those thoughts, the negative self-talk and things like that. And again, none of this is what we want to do. It's not like we wake up and go to these things. It just can tend to happen. And in group therapy, like you said, just getting those perspective changes and, you know, hearing what other people are saying or the words that they're using to describe it. It's like this small aha moment. Like, okay, I get that. I see that. Well, thanks for sharing that. This is interesting. The 12-step programs, I think a lot of people hear 12-step and they automatically pair that with what? AA.
AA,
right?
Yeah.
So, but there's so many more type or variances of 12-step. Mm-hmm. One that I'm familiar with is a faith-based 12-step program.
Yes.
That's
what I did. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did a 12-step program through my church. It's called Regeneration. Yeah. They also have one called Celebrate Recovery at other churches. Mm-hmm. And I, again, like highly, highly recommend. I just think that the 12 steps are very, very similar from my understanding to the 12 steps of AA. And like, even if someone wanted to go to a secular 12-step program, I think there's just so much benefit of the way that you live your life with that. It's one of the things that I took away from it that I think is so helpful is like daily inventory of like heart like hard things, like hurts that you've done, that someone has done to you, and then working through that and not letting it just build up and not letting that resentment grow. Like, let me go apologize to whoever and make amends for whatever I need to do. And then even if they don't accept it, it relieves that feeling inside of you. It takes it off your plate. You're like, I did what I could do, and now I have to give it up to my higher power. And also with, you know, going to people and telling them how they've harmed you and the like repair that can come from that. That's something that I still struggle with, but
that's hard.
Yeah.
So do you have success stories of that though, of being able to let somebody know that they did hurt you and you were able to express that in a healthy manner?
Yeah, I'm working on that, especially with my family. Like, you know, like I said, like there is pain points of like, maybe why didn't you see this in what I was going through, or why did you respond this way or that way? But part of it is in therapy learning, like, yes, it was a different generation, and they, you know, I'm half Indian. There's different cultural aspects. There's so many things that go into how someone might respond. Mm-hmm. So understanding that, but also talking about it with the person, and then they're like, I didn't even know that I had hurt you, you know? And so, and I don't want to, and just growing from that, and you end up having a much closer relationship even than you did before. I mean, I really believe, like, as much as I tend to be a conflict avoidant person, like, I think the whole purpose of conflicts is actually to draw us closer together.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. How much lighter do you feel each time you're able to speak up to someone in that manner?
A million times. And I just feel stronger. I feel so empowered. I feel invincible. You know, it's like, oh, nothing can touch me. I have the power to say what I need to say.
And you do. I mean, we do. We just have to be able to tap into that power. And my goodness, Alyssa, you've definitely done the work. And that's important to let people know, too. This is not a quick process. Like, the feelings and emotions, like, we have to be able to sit with that for a time, right? To be able to even identify or let alone get to the point of offloading it, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm so impressed is the word. The amount of work that you've put in, and we're not even halfway through this conversation, but that's like, you've got to be committed to this.
Yes. Right? I think that some of it comes from desperation of just wanting to feel better. But some of it comes from a place of curiosity and like, just, this has become my passion. Mental health has become my passion. And I want to explore everything that there is to explore so that maybe it can help me. Maybe it can help someone else that I know. So just that hope that's there. Like, I keep a list in my phone of like treatments that I haven't tried, things that I haven't tried, because even as much as I have tried, there's still other things out there, and there's always hope, and they're always developing new things. And so just remembering that no matter how much it feels like you've tried and things maybe don't feel like they've gotten better, one, when I look back, I'm like, things really have gotten better, even when they don't feel like they have. But two, there's always, things could change tomorrow. Things can change in 12 months. I mean, things can be so different treatment-wise or just life circumstance-wise. And so it's just important to always hold on and keep going.
Well, in the episodes that come on too, I'm saying that because you said things could change like literally tomorrow or 12 months from now. Well, the episodes can change too, like, or differ rather. So certain episodes could maybe last a day, 3 days, a month, 6 months. I mean, there's been times where I've spent several weeks into several months, like literally in bed, calling into work. I've lost jobs due to these type of episodes. And but you never know, right? And I think it does not, I'm not going to say easy, but it gets a little bit more manageable the more tools you're adding to the toolbox, because you can kind of filter through those and see what may work during that particular episode. But there's also a sense of, and I want you to speak into this, there's, you said it earlier, like a lower level of depression that's there constantly. Is that right?
Yeah.
Can you speak into that?
Yeah. So I've been talking with my therapist about this, and they think that potentially I might have what's called persistent depressive disorder. It's also, it used to be called dysthymia or dysthymic disorder. And
this is umbrellaed under the TRD, right?
Yes. So TRD can be major depressive disorder, or it can be this persistent depressive disorder, and maybe other types of depression as well. It's basically referring to the difficulty with treatment versus like the type of depression. Okay. So for persistent depressive disorder to be diagnosed, you have to experience depression most of the day, most days, for at least 2 years or 1 year in children. And it is more likely to be treatment resistant as well. So that's something that I feel that I struggle with, is that I do have depressive episodes, like someone with MDD, where I will be in bed for 3 days and can't get out, and I'm crying nonstop. But the majority of the time for me, it's more of a low level of depression. I call it low level. It very much affects my life, and it's very difficult, but it's something that I'm able to manage. So I have like chronic fatigue, and those negative thoughts, and the low self-esteem, and some of those things, but I'm not I'm able to get out of bed. I'm not crying without cause. So there's just kind of a difference in those levels of depression, I think. Mm-hmm. But it can be very difficult to deal with this, what you want to call low level of depression, every day, because, again, that affects your feeling of hope and like, when is this going to go away, and how can I keep living with this? How can I manage this? Mm-hmm. And some days I feel like I've got this. Like, I know all the things that I need to do that help me. I know I can go outside. I can go for walks. I can talk to my friends. I can go to a support group. I can do all of these things. And then other days, it is hard to hold on to that hope.
Mm-hmm. And I know that you've got some really great stories of hope to share with us, but I'd like to back up a little bit to discuss the signs and symptoms mm-hmm. of treatment-resistant depression. Can you speak into what those look like for you, as well as to just the public who's dealing with this?
Yes. So before I was like medicated, there was a lot of like crying without reason, frustration or anger over small things, feeling hopeless or empty, irritable, annoyed mood, loss of interest or pleasure in things that you usually enjoy, loss of interest or conflict with family and friends, low self-esteem, feelings of worthlessness or guilt, fixation on past failures, exaggerated self-blame, self-criticism, extreme sensitivity to rejection or failure, needing excessive reassurance from others, trouble thinking, concentrating, making decisions, remembering things, ongoing sense that life and the future are grim and bleak, and frequent thoughts of death, dying, or suicide.
Mm-hmm. And these are the symptoms.
Yes.
Okay. So what differs from, and that's quite the list. And, you know, and honestly, in reading these, I was checking off a lot.
I know.
But that's common. We want to let people know, anybody who's dealing with any level of depression right now hearing this, please don't necessarily self-diagnose. Like, it's of course fine, right, to relate. But it is important to not self-diagnose. But at the same time, these are symptoms that we can all almost feel a sense of relief in knowing that somebody else feels these, right?
And knowing that it's real. Because sometimes it feels like, I always say it is in my head, but it feels like it's in my head, you know, where it feels like, do I really have depression, or am I lazy, or am I, you know, making excuses for myself or something? And it feels, because it's so intangible and it's so difficult to see, unless maybe you get an MRI on your head, it can be difficult to really understand that that is what I'm going through, and to explain to others that that's what I'm going through.
Sure. Do you think, though, in part that comes from the stigma associated with mental health? Some of those thoughts of like what you just said, like, oh, maybe this is not depression. Maybe it is laziness or
XYZ. Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's still messages out there that depression isn't real.
Mm-hmm.
And that people who are dealing with depression, you know, are lazy, or are making excuses for themselves, or maybe they're dealing with it, but if they just changed the way that they thought, if they just thought positively, then they wouldn't be dealing with it anymore. I think there's a lot of misconceptions about depression still in the general world.
Yeah, and absolutely in the general world, and then also in people that are extremely close to us. I have found, and with you being a woman of faith and me being a man of faith, it's this is almost difficult to say, but it's sometimes like we're treated as though by our Christian brothers and sisters, as though maybe our life is full of sin and this is like a punishment for it. Or, hey, if your prayer life was better, you could just pray this away.
Yes.
And while, of course, our God is a redemptive God and a gracious God, of course, but at the same time, he's a permissive God. Mm-hmm. You know, we know the story of Jacob wrestling with God. We know the story of the thorn in Paul's side, right? Have you ever had to deal with difficult conversations or perspectives in that regard with your Christian friends?
Oh, absolutely. I went to a church where I think the first sermon that I sat in was against medication and how depression is a spiritual disease. And basically, like, it's because you don't have, you're sinning, or you don't have your priorities in order or something, that this is, that's why you're struggling. Mm-hmm. And that's really unfortunate. And I think that the church is really, from my experience, coming around to like understand mental health and be involved in it. And there's all kinds of like Christian counselors now that are, that are, you know, weaving faith and mental health together. And I think that that's so incredible. And that was the experience I had too at the clinic that I went for an IOP, and they had faith-based curriculum. So I think that it's getting a lot better, but I'm sure there are churches like the one that I experienced still out there where people are hearing these messages. And that makes me really sad, because I don't think that it's probably malicious. It's a misunderstanding.
Which is, again, why the stigma?
Right.
So much lack of understanding. And I want to be clear. I agree with you on that, too. It's definitely not from a malicious place at all. Mm-hmm. I definitely am confident in that. It's just the lack of awareness. But you're right. I would agree. I mean, just even over the past 10 years, I've seen programs come into church that, you know, marry the two together, mental health and faith. Mm-hmm. And I mean, look at Regen.
Yeah.
And then you said, what was the other one? Celebrate Recovery.
Yes.
And then there's Reengage. There's all these different types of classes or curriculum that are faith-based paired with that mental health recovery. And you're right on that. So those that are listening, you know, I'm so sorry. And I know, Alyssa, you just said that that makes you sad. If that's happened to you, just don't give up, mm-hmm. Which I think you're essentially the poster child for that, in regards to the fact that you went to a church your very first time visiting that church and heard a message like that. You could have easily given up,
right?
But you kept going because you knew, and that tells me that you were strong enough in your faith to know that that wasn't correct.
Yeah.
And it got to the point for me, I had to sit down one-on-one with my pastor and ask him, like, and this was recent, this was within the past 5 years, sat across the table and I'm like, you know, am I even a Christian?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is my faith real? Do I really believe Jesus conquered death? Like, all these questions and this doubt came in, because it gets to the point where if you're listening to a select few around you, even if they think that they're coming from a loving place, you can tend to start to doubt a lot of things, right? And think that it's just brought on your own, or like, you know, believing that, well, I can just pray my way out of that. Again, prayer is powerful, of course, but at the same time, it's a real thing that we're battling.
Yeah.
It's not just that we're, you know, living in sin. So all of this is self-inflicted.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think the doubts can come too, just even if you aren't blaming yourself, but just from the fact that this is like a disease that you're suffering, it's a thorn in your side. And that can always cause doubt, and that can cause, you know, it's difficult to hold on sometimes to what you believe. And I've struggled with that a lot too. Mm-hmm. But I think that that's when it's the most important also. And so definitely I encourage people to try to like stick with their faith and find a place that is welcoming and understanding of mental health. And if you're in like a small town or somewhere where that's not available, like, maybe find online resources. But it is so important to be encouraged by other people who really understand what you're going through.
Yeah, that's good. Thanks for sharing that piece of it. So let's get into the signs. So we discussed the symptoms. What does it look like? What could a close friend or family member, what could they be alarmed by and pay attention to if you're presenting these signs?
So some of the signs are tiredness, lack of energy, insomnia or the reverse, sleeping too much, use of alcohol or drugs or any kind of like coping mechanism to numb, agitation, restlessness or slowed thinking, speaking and body movements, unexplained body aches or headaches, social isolation, less attention to personal hygiene or appearance, angry outbursts, risky behavior or acting out, and self-harm. So it's kind of interesting because some of them are like the opposites. But the ones I've experienced is like the tiredness, lack of energy, sleeping too much, versus like some people experience insomnia. I've used, you know, numbing coping behaviors before, social isolation, and then less attention to personal hygiene and appearance. Those are the ones that I've struggled with.
Yeah, I'm going down the list here, and the same. Social isolation was the most devastating for me, because that's where I was in the dark and doing things in the dark that, you know, are not healthy, like the use of drugs and alcohol and just other types of behavior. And then, of course, the personal hygiene or appearance, like for me, it just gets to the point of just wanting to just give up, right? And that's definitely a telltale sign for me too. So, this is a very descriptive list of signs.
And I like to talk about the hygiene thing because I think it's can be embarrassing to talk about, but it's something that so many people struggle with, and we don't necessarily, like, I think there's shame around it, and we don't, because we don't talk about it. And in the IOP program I had, we did this exercise where people would say something that they struggled with, and then everybody would take a step in if they also struggled with it. And it helped you to see, like, oh, all of these things that I thought I was struggling in alone, like, other people are struggling in too. And I said, like, I struggled to, like, brush my teeth or take a shower. And almost everybody took a step in, because that's something that it truly is a sign of depression. And it's not a sign of just not being a good enough person, you know, like we can tell ourselves. So that's something that I just wanted to highlight too.
Yeah. And there's sometimes just brushing our teeth or taking a shower, that's the only win for the day.
Mm-hmm.
So, and a lot of people could possibly think, well, how in the world, like, how can you be so excited about that? Well, because otherwise, like, that's something that we strive to maybe the entire day to get to that point of taking a shower. It's like, we know we need to shower.
Yes.
But the strength that it takes to get there and to go through the motions, like, we just don't have the energy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have so much fatigue that some days when I take a shower, I mean, I have a chair in the shower so that I can take a shower, because I can't stand and shower for the whole time. So, I think that's something that people don't realize, how difficult it can be to do daily tasks like that.
Yeah. And speaking of just the difficulty in daily tasks and taking care of yourself, what are some of the self-care techniques that have worked for you or that you would recommend others?
One of the biggest things for me is spending time outside, especially when it's sunny. If there's no sun, doing like a sauna can be really helpful. Taking walks, or doing any kind of like light exercise. I usually can't motivate myself to do like vigorous exercise. I know that can be helpful too, but just being okay with that and saying, like, even if I walk to the end of the corner, that is something. Mm-hmm. And that is doing something for my mental health. And so just those small goals, spending time with other people, going to bed early. And I try not to, like, sleep in late. Luckily, I have a daughter, so I can't sleep in too late.
Right.
But trying to, like, put these safeguards for yourself so that you don't sleep too much, because that can actually, the more that you sleep, I find, can make you more tired, and it can, you know, negatively affect you. And then you're also going to have that negative self-talk about sleeping too much and not getting things done. So that's something I've avoided drinking, because it's a depressant, any kind of drugs or anything like that. So just making that choice for yourself, and knowing that you're doing something healthy for yourself, that can be really great. I do my support groups, I do Bible study and going to church, which can be encouraging. And then I volunteer with NAMI. It's called National Alliance on Mental Illness. And they do a lot of different things. They do presentations about mental health in schools. They do classes for people who are struggling with their mental health, as well as for like the loved ones of people and support groups. And they do advocacy as well for like laws about mental health. But what I find really helpful, and I've just started volunteering with them, but what I find really helpful is they give you the opportunity to tell your story and to share with people, and like what I'm doing right here. Like, this is so cathartic. And so I really encourage people, like, it just, it helps to feel like you, your story is helping other people, and to feel again, like there's that purpose to what you're going through. And it also gives you, if you want to do the support group or you want to do the class, like it gives you an opportunity again to connect with other people who are going through the same thing, to learn, you know, strategies to managing depression, all of those things. So NAMI is an awesome organization, and I just want to get their name out there because I think they do great work.
Yeah, and we'll definitely leave how to get the resource in the show notes. We'll plug that and you know, give people access to that website. But if somebody wanted to get involved in that, just briefly, like how would they go about getting involved? Because you're in the advocacy program, right? Like you're becoming certified to, to do certain things.
Yes. And
what are those things?
So I have become certified to teach what's called a peer-to-peer class. So it's someone who struggles with a mental health condition teaching other people who struggle with a mental health condition about this curriculum that NAMI has developed. And then I have also become certified just to share my story at and do presentations in schools for students. I'm working on becoming certified to lead support groups as well. So there's all kinds of different options for volunteering as well. And anytime you volunteer, if NAMI is not your thing, but just volunteering and helping someone else, it can help you kind of get out of just the mindset of like everything that's going on with you.
Sure.
And focusing on someone else, and you can get a lot of just, you know, positive feedback from helping someone else.
And of course, just encouragement in general.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Just taking that microscope off yourself for a minute, just to unplug, so to speak. And it's not an escape by any means at all, but it to me, it broadens your perspective.
Yes.
Right. And caring and serving others. So now the classes and support groups and things that you're talking about that you're certified in, when people go to the NAMI website to inquire about these things, is it like an insurance-based thing, or is NAMI a nonprofit and they provide all this stuff free?
Yeah, they're a nonprofit. They provide everything for free. And you can go to NAMI.org to find out more. There's different chapters. It's a nationwide thing. So there's different chapters depending on where you might live. I volunteer with NAMI North Texas, which is like Dallas, Denton, and Collin County.
Okay.
But there's different resources depending on where you live, and you can get plugged in with someone who can let you know what's available in your area.
That's great. That's great. I'm probably going to talk to you more about that.
Yes.
That just sounds incredible. Now, if people wanted to set anything up with you and learn more, could we put your email address in with mine in the show
Absolutely.
Notes?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. And then I know that would be great for you too, just with your advocacy. So I will definitely do that. We'll talk more on that afterwards.
Awesome.
That's really neat. So you've got some messages of hope, I know. Do you mind sharing some of those with us just as we get to wrapping up? Because I know that there's some people out there that have to be pushed to actually listen to this. Mm-hmm. And I say that the example, I've got a friend who came to me once, and this was probably halfway mid recording and distributing these episodes. But he was telling me about a friend who ended up getting a lot out of it. But he had to push him. He said that he was like, Zach, I had to like, you know, play it for him. I had to get it in front of him. He ended up having to listen to it like 5 times before he was able to get all the way through it. Well, once he got through it, it was so impactful that it started this ripple effect in him and around him of positivity and healing. So I preface all that in saying, like, what would you say to the one person who's catching a glimpse of this in hopes that what you have to say is relatable? Like, in other words, what if this was your only opportunity to share, right? Mm-hmm. I want you to take that and use that in what you share with us right now. If this was it for you, this was the last time you were able to share, put it all out on the table, what kind of message of hope would you give?
I would say about 2 years ago, I was in the darkest place in my life and I couldn't see a way forward. I was struggling with suicidal ideation. I was so overwhelmed. I felt like everything I was doing was a mistake. I felt terrible about myself, horrible self-esteem, just every symptom that you could say of depression and feeling the lowest of the low. And now where my life is, like, is so incredible. Not because I have, you know, I'm doing all these things or I have all these things, but just like I truly, despite like still having a level of depression, I truly can enjoy things in my life. And I have like just a loving family and I have my daughter. And I think that it's so important to know, like, when you are in a low place, you are not going to be there forever. And there is hope and there's people who want to help you. And I remember one of your, I think maybe the postpartum depression one, she talked about just wishing that someone would reach out to her when she was in such a low place. And I know that feeling too. And sometimes people don't reach out and you have to be the one to reach out and you have to, you know, there's, I mean, I called when I was in a dark place, I called the National Suicide Hotline every day because I felt like, and it wasn't true, but I felt like there was no one else that I could talk to. But no matter what, no matter how alone you feel, there is someone to talk to. And there's someone who wants to hear. And there's someone who cares about your life and you being here and you having a good life and enjoying your life. And that is a possibility for you. And if there, you know, if it's no one else, then it's us. Like Zach and I want to hear from you. Mm-hmm. And so I just think that just knowing that things can really change and they can change quicker than you believe and reaching out for help and knowing that there's so many treatment options, even if you've tried, like I can tell myself I've tried everything. There's new things being developed all the time. There are psychiatrists that want to help you. There are therapists that want to help you. I know, you know, money can sometimes be an object, but there's sliding scale things. There's nonprofits. Mm-hmm. Things aren't always easy, but there are ways to get help. And so I would just encourage everyone to just reach out to someone. And if you feel like maybe you're not in a place where you can set yourself up to go to an IOP or to even get set up with a support group or something, if there's one person that you know that you can say to that person, like, I need help, can you set this up for me? That can be huge. Just having an advocate, if you can't advocate for yourself, having someone who can advocate for you and knowing who that person is.
That's so good. That's so good. Thank you for that. Now, let's talk to your younger self. Mm. I think you probably knew that was coming. So what would you tell the 16-year-old Alyssa if you had the opportunity to do so?
Gosh, I just wish I could tell her not to be so hard on herself. Mm. I wish I could say, you have a kind soul. You are beautiful. You are strong. You are stronger than you think that you are. And you're going to get through this and you're going to have a good life.
Yeah. That's good. That's good. I think that just hit me. Cause I don't know that I've done that.
Yeah.
You know, I ask people this question all the time, but I don't know that I've ever talked to my younger self.
Would you do that?
Yeah. You know, I would, very similar, but to speak it out loud, I would, you know, tell Zach that he's okay and that it's okay to take the mask off. That people do care about him, that people see him, and that he has a purpose, and that he's loved, and that he's worth it. Yeah. I need to do some work.
I love it.
With that. Yeah. Wow. That caught me off guard. That's the first time this has happened. It caught me off guard, but I love it. That's what's so great, about doing this and speaking openly with each other, you know, hearing your perspective, it's pierced me, you know, in a manner that is freeing, to know that there is healing, there's ways to manage, that we don't always have to look back on our past and be ashamed of it, that it's okay to talk to our younger selves like we just did, which I just did. I just think I completely underestimated how powerful that is. You know, and I would forgive myself too. I would extend myself a lot more grace.
You were a kid.
Yeah.
That's also crazy to think about.
It is.
Like, we were struggling with all of this and we were kids and we didn't know.
Yeah. You know, and I would also tell my parents that it's okay. It's okay to not know what to do. You know, I think there's a lot of times my wife and I will tell our kids, like, hey, we've not done this before.
Yes.
Like, cut us some slack, you know? Yeah.
It's funny being on the other side of parenting now, right?
Where
you
think,
like, you thought your parents had all the answers, but now there's some compassion where it's like, oh, yeah, we don't know what we're doing.
Yeah.
We're just trying to do the best we can.
Yeah. And as kids, too, like, we were trying to do the best we could.
Yes.
And, you know, and it's really okay to not know what to ask or how to ask it, you know, and but at the same time, like, I don't know. Like, I think we would be here for another several hours if we were to really unpack this. We'll have to do that later. But, you know, I appreciate your authenticity throughout this episode. And, you know, personally, what it just did for me, and I know that you guys can't see us right now, but just the way that you expressed that with such confidence and clarity and empathy and compassion, the way you were talking to your younger self, your whole being shifted. And I think that's what pierced me, is that, you know, we do love ourselves. Like, just because we face depression and anxiety and even as far as the suicidal ideation, that doesn't mean that we don't have love for ourselves. It's just that maybe we don't know how to love ourselves, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I've never thought about it like that. I really love that.
Yeah. And, but for me, I hadn't thought about that either, I don't think, until it was seeing my younger self in front of me, speaking to him, you know, and now there's just, there's so much going on in my head right now of what to do and how to process that in a good way, like, not in a fearful way at all. It's just a very freeing moment. But I think we also have to be postured to be able to receive things like this, like what just happened. You know, I think it's extremely important to I'm not going to say completely drop your guard, because I be vulnerable all the time. I don't think that that's very healthy. I think there are times where you really have to protect yourself, especially in today's day and age.
Yes.
Well, that makes me sound old even saying. But just to be postured in safe positions. Let me clarify that. So, like, this is a safe space, right? So I would feel that we're both postured to be able to receive as much as we're giving. So, and what I mean by that is just a sense of openness and vulnerability with each other to be able to receive what the other may have, if that makes sense. So hopefully the people listening to this podcast, I would encourage you to posture yourself in that manner. You know, maybe not in a manner of overthinking or overanalyzing everything that we're saying and how it applies to them, but just being able to receive what it is that we're saying, just so they're not alone.
Yeah.
And just so they do feel like, hey, it's okay. I can be myself. It's okay to be myself. One thing that came to mind too, as I was thinking about my younger self and hearing you speak to your younger self, do you find it beneficial to apologize to yourself today?
Yes, actually, that's something you taught me, honestly, is you told me that you teach your kids to apologize to themselves in the mirror when they do something to hurt themselves. And I was like, wow, I love that. We practice with my daughter just saying I love you in the mirror, and we'll give ourselves a hug and a kiss at night. Because we should love ourselves, and we do love ourselves. But I think that that is also important, the apology, the way that you show that you love yourself, not just tell yourself, but you show that the same way that you would, we were talking about like repairing with other people and stuff, like you need to repair with yourself too.
Yeah. Does that get hard though? Like, are you quick to apologize to yourself? Because I'm not. Like, it does take some work for me to get to the point to even face myself in the mirror at times.
Yes.
How is that for you? Like, maybe it's not necessarily a habit right now to apologize to yourself like that.
Yeah.
But what practice do you put in place to extend yourself grace when it gets to that point?
Something that I learned in therapy is like, basically, if somebody was born in the same circumstances as you and they went through all the same things as you, they would have made the same decisions. So you maybe made decisions that were not good decisions, that were harmful to yourself, harmful to others. But it's not an excuse, but it is a reason of like, there were a lot of things that led up to that. And have compassion for yourself and be like, okay, like, I'm letting that go. I'm forgiving myself for those things, and reach out to the people that also you want to, apologize to and make amends to, but also realizing you don't need their forgiveness. You need to, like I said, for me, following the 12 steps, it felt like it's getting it off my plate. It's just not, it's not for me anymore. Now it's for my higher power, for me, God. But knowing that I did everything that I could do in my power, and knowing that line of like, what is in my control and what is not in my control. And now I have to give it up to God.
That's great. I like that. Not just to reiterate, you said not everybody has to forgive you, right? Yeah. Cause for me, that the word that came to mind was approval. Cause in a lot of this, like I just speaking for myself, will seek approval from others in my healing journey.
Yes.
Which there has to come a point where I truly believe that we have to do this for ourselves. A lot of times we do use like our spouses or our kids or even our place of employment to use that as motivation. Hey, we need to get better for them. But tell me, how important is it to be able to get to that spot to where you're doing it for you? Right? Like you're doing it for you, and knowing that when you do it for you in the healing, that it will cause that ripple effect and it will benefit in a positive manner to those outside, that ripple effect hitting, you know, of course, your kids, your spouse, your place of employment. But that's not always a quick pinpoint, right? Like, it help me make sense of that.
So, I understand. It's like your kids and your husband or your wife, in a sense, they're a good motivator. Of course, you want to do well for them, but it really can't be about that. It really does have to be about loving yourself, because everything that you do with that intention is just so much more powerful to yourself. The way that you talked to yourself, your younger self right now, with love and compassion, that power is so different from if you told your younger self like something because it was for your wife or for your kids. Like, it's still a beautiful thing, but I think that it does, like, I don't know. I think it's just the way that we're built, that we do have to like give that compassion to ourselves to really like receive it.
And I've noticed that's part of the stigma too, is that people can, and this just comes part along with the approval seeking, is that they think it's selfish. Like when we say, hey, we've got to do this for ourselves, like we have to take time for self-care or self-development. I could see how that could come off self-centered almost or selfish, but we're not meaning that, right? Like it's not, that's what we want people to know. This is not a selfish pursuit. It's not a self ambitious motive. There's not one behind that. It's other than just healing. Right. And I think it's important for people to know that may not experience anything that we're talking about. Maybe they're listening to this to see how they could better support their friend or family member. I think it's extremely important to know that this is not a selfish act at all. And it, when we certainly don't want to do this by ourselves. We want the people. We want the support. Sometimes we just, like you said earlier, we've said multiple times, we may not know how to ask for it. And a lot of times we may not know how to accept it. You know, that's the other side of the coin there. Like there can be a sense of pride that we get tangled up in this thinking that, hey, we have to, of course, fix this ourselves. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's us. It's a self-healing process, so to speak. But we also do need to include others, right?
Absolutely.
We want to be able to draw upon that support and draw upon it, especially like you just mentioned, for you, your higher power is God. And that is for me. That is a sense of strength for me as well. And just to go back a little bit earlier, when we were talking about the thorn in the side and essentially looking at this as a blessing, mm-hmm. right? And how we could help others or, you know, just be more empathetic and compassionate. But personally for me, I relate so much to that story of Jacob because it draws me so much closer to God. I've never been closer to God than I am in these episodes or maybe in between these episodes. But what I've discovered is that it keeps me tethered to him. It keeps me pursuing him,
yeah.
You know, and of course there are times where, you know, I'll doubt or I'll get angry with God and I, you know, my relationship, I have it out with God, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Like, some people probably drive by the yard sometimes when I'm on a walk and I'm just flailing, you know, just speaking out loud. But that's my relationship with God, right? And again, I just love the story of Jacob because he refused to let go until he was blessed. And that's how I like to look at this. Not a selfish, not a self-ambitious type motive as far as like, hey, God, I'm not going to stop doing this until you bless me. Nothing like that. It's just the blessing is that relationship itself.
Yeah.
So that's how I've been able to reframe this as far as my depression and anxiety, because it is ongoing. I've overcome, just like you have overcome just a tremendous amount of what we've gone through, but there's still that level of maintenance. There's still that level of managing as we continue to navigate, right? And so it's really important for me to recognize this as a blessing as opposed to a curse.
Yes.
I think if we get caught up on those type of negative connotative names, like saying it's a curse, I think that inhibits our growth.
Yeah.
Right.
I agree. I think that it's so beautiful and wonderful to be able to see it as a blessing at times. Mm-hmm. I think that there's times you're going to see it as a curse, no
sure.
matter what.
Yeah.
And like you said, in those times, being able to be angry with God, it kind of goes back to what we talked about conflict drawing people closer together.
Yeah.
Conflict with God draws us closer to God too.
Yeah. I'm glad you said that. It's, and again, this, we keep coming back to what stigmatizes this as far as talking about our mental health. But I just want to highlight the fact that it really is a lack of understanding and awareness. I want to drive home the fact that we know that a lot of the stigma is not nefarious or malicious whatsoever at all.
Yes.
Again, it's just that lack of awareness and understanding. And I say that to say just an overwhelming thank you for what you just did for myself and for all those listening. Your story is filled with a lot of emotion. I definitely sensed a lot of pain, but more so than anything else, I've seen in you courage. I've seen, you know, power. You said earlier about yourself, you just feel empowered. That's what's radiating from you right now. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important for people to know that Alyssa's not sitting here timid at all. She definitely knows who she is, and you're willing to share that with the world in hopes that other people can relate. And you're doing it with just such a courage. And I want to make sure that you don't leave here without hearing that this is incredible what you're doing. And again, it takes so much to do what you're doing. It takes so much strength. You have to be brave. You have to be resilient. You have to be compassionate, empathetic, and gracious to just all the things, right? And you're radiating that. So all the work that you've been doing over the years, it's definitely coming out in you right now. And this is me just only knowing you 4 to 5 weeks. So I can't imagine what others who've known you for 20, 30 years could say. And I hope that they're telling you that. I hope that you have people in your corner that are able to tell you, hey, Alyssa, like, you've made strides. Like, you've just been nailing it. You know, all these things, not for approval, of course, but just to encourage you. So tell me that you do have those people, right?
Yes. Okay. And I'm so grateful that you're one of those people and that you just said all of that. And I'm really like receiving that. That was amazing. And I wish too that everyone out there who has also been struggling, like I want them to take that for themselves too. And mm-hmm. to be like, you are strong. You have been fighting so hard and you are resilient and you're courageous.
Yeah, we are. We're fighters and we're not going to give up. I love that. Absolutely love that. So let's wrap up by just extending some of those resources again real quick. Honestly, I think it's the most important one that all of us should have in our toolbox, and that's the suicide prevention hotline. It's 988lifeline.org, or you could dial 988 and get a hold of somebody. Did you have another way that you were able to get through?
No, I think when I called was before they were 988, but okay. now it's great that they're 988 and you just got that in your toolbox ready to call. I love it.
So Alyssa, can we go over some of those resources again just as we wrap up? I know that we talked about your experience with the suicide hotline. Mm-hmm. What I know that to be is 988lifeline.org. Do you have another way of reaching them?
So not that one, but I can give a few other resources as well. 988 is great, and I highly recommend that. Also NAMI.org, like I talked about. If you are dealing with postpartum depression or postpartum, Postpartum Support International is a great resource for support groups and things like that. I highly recommend 12-step groups, whether secular or through like your local church, Regeneration, Celebrate Recovery. Okay. And I also highly recommend IOP or PHP. If you're in a place where maybe you're experiencing some suicidal ideation, that's a really great time to go do that. And that's offered usually at some different hospitals and things like that. So you would have to see what's in your area, but okay. I would recommend that.
Great. And any books, any classes, anything? Of course, you just gave us those, but any books that you have come across over the years that really stand out that helped you?
I would say the classic like Boundaries book by Henry Cloud. That's a big one. The Attachment book is a great book. Okay. There's so many great books. But anything that maybe has to do with like kind of living with depression and finding hope would sure. be my recommendation.
Yeah. And what we'll do for everybody is that I'll get you to email me a list of these resources and we'll make them available in the show notes. And we'll go back through, of course, you know, the podcast to see what we referenced to make sure that we're not leaving anything out. Because we definitely jam-packed this thing full with, tools and resources. I think a lot of people will have plenty to digest. And we definitely just encourage everybody to leave comments here. The comments are open. They do not need to be reviewed. So please just load us up with comments and questions if you have them. And we can definitely do our best to get you the answers that you deserve. So I just want to leave everybody with the fact that, hey, you're worth it. You're loved. You have a purpose. All the above when it comes to who you are. Give yourself grace. Give yourself some compassion. And any last thoughts for us today?
Just thank you guys so much for listening to my story. And I'd love to connect with anyone who's going through it or has a loved one who's going through it. We're all here for each other.
Sounds great. Well, Alyssa, thank you so much. And definitely we'll have to have you back again. So guys, thanks so much again for listening. If you will, just please like and share and follow the Who We Are podcast, a mental health podcast hosted by Zach Moloch. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.